Then, after a little pause, "This last week or two," he went on, "I've been cutting all my committees and all my girls. You can't imagine what a hullabaloo they've been making about it at the college. Still, it's been worth it, I think. The effects..." He hesitated. "Well, they're odd. They're very odd." A physical shortcoming could produce a kind of mental excess. The process, it seemed, was reversible. Mental excess could produce, for its own purposes, the voluntary blindness and deafness of deliberate solitude, the artificial impotence of asceticism. The rest of the short flight was accomplished in silence. When they had arrived and were comfortably stretched out on the pneumatic sofas in Bernard's room, Helmholtz began again. Speaking very slowly, "Did you ever feel," he asked, "as though you had something inside you that was only waiting for you to give it a chance to come out? Some sort of extra power that you aren't using, you know, like all the water that goes down the falls instead of through the turbines?" He looked at Bernard questioningly.
"You mean all the emotions one might be feeling if things were different?"
Helmholtz shook his head.
"Not quite. I'm thinking of a queer feeling I sometimes get, a feeling that I've got something important to say and the power to say it, only I don't know what it is, and I can't make any use of the power. If there was some different way of writing, or else something else to write about..."
He was silent. Then, "You see," he went on at last, "I'm pretty good at inventing phrases. You know, the sort of words that suddenly make you jump, almost as though you'd sat on a pin. They seem so new and exciting, even though they're about something hypnopedically obvious. But that doesn't seem enough. It's not enough for the phrases to be good. What you make with them ought to be good, too."
"But your things are good, Helmholtz."
"Oh, as far as they go..." Helmholtz shrugged his shoulders. "But they go such a little way. They aren't important enough, somehow. I feel I could do something much more important. Yes, and much more intense, more violent. But what? What is there more important to say? And how can one be violent about the sort of things one's expected to write about? Words can be like X-rays, if you use them properly. They'll go through anything. You read, and you're pierced. That's one of the things I try to teach my students, how to write piercingly. But what on earth's the good of being pierced by an article about a community sing or the latest improvements in scent organs? Besides, can you make words really piercing, you know, like the very hardest X-rays, when you're writing about that sort of thing? Can you say something about nothing? That's what it finally boils down to. I try and I try..."
"Hush,"
said Bernard suddenly, and lifted a warning finger. They listened.
"I believe there's somebody at the door,"
he whispered. Helmholtz got up, tiptoed across the room, and with a sharp, quick movement, flung the door wide open. There was, of course, nobody there.
"I'm sorry," said Bernard, feeling and looking uncomfortably foolish. "I suppose I've got things on my nerves a bit. When people are suspicious with you, you start being suspicious with them."
He passed his hand across his eyes. He sighed. His voice became plaintive. He was justifying himself.
"If you knew what I had to put up with recently," he said almost tearfully,
and the uprush of his self-pity was like a fountain suddenly released.
"If you only knew..."
Helmholtz Watson listened with a certain sense of discomfort. "Poor little Bernard," he said to himself. But at the same time, he felt rather ashamed for his friend. He wished Bernard would show a little more pride. Chapter 5. By 8 o'clock, the light was failing. The loudspeakers in the tower of the Stoke Poges clubhouse began, in a more than human tenor, to announce the closing of the courses.
Lenina and Henry abandoned their game and walked back towards the club. From the grounds of the Internal and External Secretion Trust came the lowing of those thousands of cattle which provided, with their hormones and their milk, the raw materials for the great factory at Farnham Royal. The incessant buzzing of helicopters filled the twilight. Every 2.5 minutes a bell and the screech of whistles announced the departure of one of the light monorail trains which carried the lower caste golfers back from their separate course to the metropolis. Lenina and Henry climbed into their machine and started off. At 800 feet, Henry slowed down the helicopter screws, and they hung for a minute or two poised above the fading landscape. The forest of Burnham Beeches stretched like a great pool of darkness towards the bright shore of the western sky. Crimson at the horizon, the last of the sunset faded through orange, upwards into yellow, and a pale, watery green. Northwards, beyond and above the trees, the Internal and External Secretions Factory glared with a fierce electric brilliance from every window of its 20 stories. Beneath them lay the buildings of the golf club, the huge lower-caste barracks, and on the other side of a dividing wall, the smaller houses reserved for Alpha and Beta members. The approaches to the monorail station were black with the ant-like pollution of lower-caste activity. From under the glass vault, a lighted train shot out into the open. Following its southeasterly course across the dark plain, their eyes were drawn to the majestic buildings of the Slough Crematorium. For the safety of night-flying planes, its 4 tall chimneys were floodlighted and tipped with crimson danger signals. It was a landmark.
"Why do the smokestacks have those things like balconies around them?" inquired Lenina.
"Phosphorus recovery," explained Henry telegraphically. "On their way up the chimney, the gases go through 4 separate treatments. P2O5 used to go right out of circulation every time they cremated someone. Now they recover over 98% of it, more than 1.5 kilos per adult corpse, which makes the best part of 400 tons of phosphorus every year from England alone." Henry spoke with a happy pride, rejoicing wholeheartedly in the achievement, as though it had been his own. "Fine to think we can go on being socially useful, even after we're dead, making plants grow." Lenina, meanwhile, had turned her eyes away and was looking perpendicularly downward at the monorail station.
"Fine," she agreed, "but queer that alphas and betas won't make any more plants grow than those nasty little gammas and deltas and epsilons down there."
"All men are physico-chemically equal," said Henry sententiously. "Besides, even epsilons perform indispensable services."
"Even an epsilon."
Lenina suddenly remembered an occasion when, as a little girl at school, she had woken up in the middle of the night and become aware for the first time of the whispering that had haunted all her sleeps. She saw again the beam of moonlight, the row of small white beds, heard once more the soft, soft voice that said — the words were there, unforgotten, unforgettable after so many night-long repetitions — "Everyone works for everyone else. We can't do without anyone. Even epsilons are useful. We couldn't do without epsilons. Everyone works for everyone else. We can't do without anyone." Lenina remembered her first shock of fear and surprise, her speculations through half a wakeful hour, and then, under the influence of those endless repetitions, the gradual soothing of her mind, the soothing, the smoothing, the stealthy creeping of sleep.
"I suppose epsilons don't really mind being epsilons," she said aloud.
"Of course they don't. How can they? They don't know what it's like being anything else. We'd mind, of course, but then we've been differently conditioned. Besides, we start with a different heredity."
"I'm glad I'm not an epsilon," said Lenina with conviction.
"And if you were an epsilon," said Henry, "your conditioning would have made you no less thankful that you weren't a beta or an alpha."
He put his forward propeller into gear and headed the machine towards London. Behind them, in the west, the crimson and orange were almost faded.
a dark bank of cloud had crept into the zenith. As they flew over the crematorium, the plane shot upwards on the column of hot air rising from the chimneys, only to fall as suddenly when it passed into the descending chill beyond. "What a marvelous switchback!" Lenina laughed delightedly. But Henry's tone was almost for a moment melancholy. "Do you know what that switchback was?" he said. "It was some human being finally and definitely disappearing, going up in a squirt of hot gas. It would be curious to know who it was, a man or a woman, an alpha or an epsilon." He sighed. Then, in a resolutely cheerful voice, "Anyhow," he concluded, "there's one thing we can be certain of. Whoever he may have been, he was happy when he was alive. Everybody's happy now."
"Yes, everybody's happy now," echoed Lenina.
They had heard the words repeated 150 times every night for 12 years. Landing on the roof of Henry's 40-story apartment house in Westminster, they went straight down to the dining hall. There, in a loud and cheerful company, they ate an excellent meal. Soma was served with the coffee. Lenina took 2 half-gram tablets and Henry 3. At 9:20, they walked across the street to the newly opened Westminster Abbey Cabaret. It was a night almost without clouds, moonless and starry. But of this, on the whole, depressing fact, Lenina and Henry were fortunately unaware. The electric sky signs effectively shut off the outer darkness. "Calvin Stopes and his 16 saxophonists!" From the façade of the new abbey, the giant letters invitingly glared, "London's finest scent and colour organ. All the latest synthetic music!" They entered. The air seemed hot and somehow breathless with the scent of ambergris and sandalwood. On the domed ceiling of the hall, the colour organ had momentarily painted a tropical sunset. The 16 saxophonists were playing an old favourite. "There ain't no bottle in all the world like that dear little bottle of mine." 400 couples were five-stepping around the polished floor. Lenina and Henry were soon the 401st. The saxophones wailed like melodious cats under the moon, moaned in the alto and tenor registers as though the little death were upon them. Rich with a wealth of harmonics, their tremulous chorus mounted towards a climax, louder and even louder, until at last, with a wave of his hand, the conductor let loose the final shattering note of ether music and blew the 16 merely human blowers clean out of existence. Thunder in A-flat major. And then, in all but silence, in all but darkness, there followed a gradual detergescence, a diminuendo sliding gradually through quarter tones down, down to a faintly whispered dominant chord that lingered on, while the 5-4 rhythm still pulsed below, charging the darkened seconds with an intense expectancy. And at last, expectancy was fulfilled. There was a sudden explosive sunrise, and simultaneously the 16 burst into song. "Bottle of mine, it's you I've always wanted. Bottle of mine, why was I ever decanted? Skies are blue inside of you, the weather's always fine, for there ain't no bottle in all the world like that dear little bottle of mine." Five-stepping with the other 400 round and round Westminster Abbey, Lenina and Henry were yet dancing in another world. The warm, richly coloured, the infinitely friendly world of Soma Holiday. How kind, how good-looking, how delightfully amusing everyone was. "Bottle of mine, it's you I've always wanted." But Lenina and Henry had what they wanted. They were inside, here and now, safely inside with the fine weather, the perennially blue sky. And when, exhausted, the 16 had laid by their saxophones, and the synthetic music apparatus was producing the very latest in slow Malthusian blues, They might have been twin embryos, gently rocking together on the waves of a bottled ocean of blood surrogate.
Good night, dear friends. Good night, dear friends.
The loudspeakers veiled their commands in a genial and musical politeness.
Good night, dear friends.
Obediently, with all the others, Lenina and Henry left the building. The depressing stars had traveled quite some way across the heavens, but though the separating screen of the sky signs had now to a great extent dissolved, the two young people still retained their happy ignorance of the night. Swallowed half an hour before closing time, that second dose of soma had raised a quite impenetrable wall between the actual universe and their minds. Bottled, they crossed the street. Bottled, they took the lift up to Henry's room on the 28th floor. And yet, bottled as she was, and in spite of that second gram of soma, Lenina did not forget to take all the contraceptive precautions prescribed by the regulations. Years of intensive hypnopedia, and from 12 to 17, Malthusian drill 3 times a week, had made the taking of these precautions almost as automatic and inevitable as blinking. "Oh, and that reminds me," she said as she came back from the bathroom. "Fanny Crown wants to know where you found that lovely green Morocco surrogate cartridge belt you gave me." Alternate Thursdays were Bernard's solidarity service days. After an early dinner at the Aphroditeum, to which Helmholtz had recently been elected under Rule 2, he took leave of his friend and, hailing a taxi on the roof, told the man to fly to the Fordson Community Singery. The machine rose a couple of 100 meters, then headed eastwards, and as it turned, there before Bernard's eyes, gigantically beautiful, was the Singery. Floodlighted, its 320 meters of white Carrara surrogate gleamed with a snowy incandescence over Ludgate Hill. At each of the 4 corners of its helicopter platform, an immense T shone crimson against the night, and from the mouths of 24 vast golden trumpets rumbled a solemn synthetic music. "Damn, I'm late," Bernard said to himself, as he first caught sight of Big Henry, the Singery clock. And sure enough, as he was paying off his cab, Big Henry sounded the hour.
"Ford," sang out an immense bass voice from all the golden trumpets. "Ford, Ford, Ford," 9 times.
Bernard ran for the lift. The great auditorium for Ford's Day celebration and other massed community sings was at the bottom of the building. Above it, 100 to each floor, were the 7,000 rooms used by solidarity groups for their fortnight services. Bernard dropped down to floor 33, hurried along the corridor, stood hesitating for a moment outside room 3,210, then, having wound himself up, opened the door and walked in. Thank Ford, he was not the last. 3 chairs of the 12, arranged round the circular table, were still unoccupied. He slipped into the nearest of them as inconspicuously as he could, and prepared to frown at the yet later comers whenever they should arrive. Turning towards him, "What were you playing this afternoon?" the girl on his left inquired. "Obstacle or electromagnetic?" Bernard looked at her. Ford, it was Morgana Rothschild, and blushingly had to admit that he had been playing neither. Morgana stared at him with astonishment. There was an awkward silence. Then, pointedly, she turned away and addressed herself to the more sporting man on her left. A good beginning for a solidarity service, thought Bernard miserably, and foresaw for himself yet another failure to achieve atonement. If only he had given himself time to look round, instead of scuttling for the nearest chair. He could have sat between Fifi Bradlaugh and Joanna Diesel, instead of which he had gone and blindly planted himself next to Morgana. Morgana! Ford! Those black eyebrows of hers, that eyebrow, rather, for they met above the nose. Ford! And on his right was Clara Detterding, True, Clara's eyebrows didn't meet, but she was really too pneumatic, whereas